It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azure Talon? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
So, guess what?
Never guess in 1,000 years.
That's probably true. I'm going to therapy. Shortly before we started this, I actually scheduled my first appointment for next week. I say going to, it's going to be telepresence, but.
Sorry, you mean like a counselor?
Yeah, like lay down on the couch, tell me about your mom kind of therapy. Yeah.
Sorry, I mean, because I know you get.
I know, I do massage therapy and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that.
It's confused, sorry.
This is straight up head shrinking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Didn't know you were thinking about that.
I've been thinking about it for a very long time. But I've been coming up with sort of pansy excuses not to do it. And then, so you remember my friend who during COVID has transitioned to being a woman?
Yes.
This is the same friend that I used to go out to dinner with once a month.
Right.
So this last week, we went out for dinner for the first time, both since COVID started and since she became a woman. We went out because it was finally the weather was decent, so we could eat at a restaurant that was outside, like get that working. And so we had a wonderful time. It was really great. But in the process, we were talking about this thing, because I've been thinking about it for a while. And a while back, I had asked her what she liked about her therapist, and she unbidden named a lot of aspects that I'm like, that's totally what I'm looking for in a therapist. And very so good. We've been talking a little bit about that, and she had said, like, actually, because you had mentioned this before, I even talked to my therapist about if this would be weird for her, and she's like, no, I'd be fine and all this. And we also talked about sort of the excuses I'd come up with why I wasn't doing it, and eventually we went on to talk about other stuff. But later that night, I was like, I just need to fucking pull the trigger on this. Like, I'm not sure what I'm waiting around for. I just need to do it. And so I did it. Well, I tried to do it. It was a little complicated this week, but I finally did it. And they called back just a little while ago and said, you can see her, but not till like November. Or we got other people here that are also cool. You could see one of those. And I was like, oh, I was really kind of into, she seemed really cool. But yeah, waiting like almost 2 months just so I can get this one, even though I've never seen her either. So I don't exactly, I'm like, that's probably dumb. So set it up with someone else for next week. And I'm suddenly the nerves are back for some reason. Like, I think having talked with my friend, I was a little more comfortable about that one. And now it's very much just a, like a dice roll again of like, this therapist may work, this therapist may not, but there's nothing on the line. I mean, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And it's like, okay, see ya. So I don't really know why I'm nervous, but I'm a little nervous. But mostly excited because, yeah, I needed to do this for a while. Everybody on the planet should probably be doing this right now, especially. But a lot of it, I mean, okay, the world's on fire. COVID's happening. On top of all of that, my life has changed drastically. And it's great. I love it. Like, at no point am I like, maybe I should be going back for a job. No, I am incredibly contented with the state and the fiber of my life, as it were. But it's very new, and I'm still negotiating how it all works. And some of that is because of COVID. And so, like, I spent so much more time alone and things like that. And I just get stuck with these times where I'm like, I'm really sad all day for no reason. Or like, I'm really nervous about something that I shouldn't be nervous. Like, and things out of nowhere. I mean, there's lots of reason to be depressed nowadays.
Sure.
There's plenty of shit. And there are days where I'm like, oh, I'm in a bad mood. And it's like, oh, because this happened or because this is going on. But then there's other days where I'm like, I'm in a bad mood. Don't know why. Fine. But yeah, I'm going to go back to bed. That kind of thing. And I just, I need some tools and some perspective on the situation, both the situation new in my life and the world situation that we all currently have to live in. That's weird. And so I think this will be good. And it's funny, for all that I've been very nervous and dragged my feet on this for a long time, now that I've like really gone for it, I'm like kind of excited because I've gotten tremendous benefit from therapy before. So
good.
Hopefully I can again. So I'm excited about that.
This makes me think about something that I've been thinking about, which is when I went to talk to my surgeon about the operation and everything, I didn't just talk to my surgeon. I mean, there's going to be a whole team of people working on various things, including, you know, yep, there's a cardiac therapist. I talked to several people who I will be talking to again after the surgery and everything. And so I thought to myself, so kind of, I'm meeting sort of the team here, but no mental health person on the team.
Yeah.
I find that interesting that that piece is overlooked. I mean, you know, there's psychiatrists there, you know, and social workers too. I mean, it's not like they don't have people there who do that kind of thing. So,
yes.
So why don't they think about it?
Well, and two, I am fairly confident they have been to a certain degree schooled on, like, the people you'll be working with, especially post surgery, probably have things to like watch, like, you know, if you're feeling like that, like signals that maybe there is a
mental health. Sure.
But you're right in that is not the same thing. And we in the US, I don't know if it's we Western medicine or we in the US, haven't quite gotten that holistic about it. Like, mental health in general is becoming more normalized, which is great, but we haven't yet gotten sort of to the part where like it proactive, I think would be what it is. Like, if you had the surgery and it caused you to have a mental breakdown, we'd all know what to do with you. But there's no like, let's help him through beforehand so he doesn't potentially have a problem later. Like,
well, right, and they're not taking that approach to other things. For example, they're going to be monitoring whether or not I have an infection and things like that.
They're not just
going to wait for me to have a fever and go, oh my gosh, I guess he has an infection, and then start caring about treating that. So the mental issue should be the same. It should be,
preventative mental health, or full stop, industry wide. I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, it just,
that is very interesting. Yeah.
And you know, one of the things that so far in my education, graduate education regarding counseling, is a focus on wellness and resilience. Also, the fact that you might see a counselor or engage with a counselor even though you don't have an illness, right? It's not pathology. It's not focused on a pathology. It's like, well, how am I doing? You know, I'm going to go see a counselor to see, you know, just sort of a checkup like you would with a doctor. Mental hygiene, you know, people talk about that. So these are things that have been addressed a lot in my classes and stuff. But I've, even before that, I was thinking about this stuff, thinking, why don't we have more, we do a lot of things for physical health that we don't do for mental health. And I can't see any reason for that. It seems like
you would
do it.
There are a lot of physical health jobs of which there is no mental health equivalent. Your average therapist is essentially like a physical therapist, but for mental stuff. But that's for, you've injured your stuff and now you need to know how to fix it.
Yeah,
and there aren't ones that are like a nutritionist or a personal trainer. I guess they are. They're called fucking life coaches. And
anyone
who's famous enough but not successful enough is one. Mental health is a thing. Mental health is still inextricably tied to woo-woo new age bullshit in certain levels, which is part of the problem. And in fact, the one therapist I had that was really detrimental incorporated a lot of that shit, which was hilarious because at the time I was a practicing Wiccan, but even I thought this was awful. And I think there's still there mental health is still sort of an alternative medicine in the same way that things like massage therapy are. And so there's still some people who are like,
I think there's even still a debate, academically speaking, as to whether or not human consciousness is even something that exists. You know, like, should we even have a discipline that in their opinion reifies a concept that it's a person's belief in their consciousness and identity and stuff that's making them sick, if they would just get over it and realize that of their stuff is just impulses and selfish genes and just get over all of the notion that any of their thoughts or consciousness or identity means anything. That's what would help them become more materialistic. I mean, I don't think that's true, but I think that debate is still taking place in academia.
Trying to remember the movie. I can't, it's not like Demolition Man or anything, but it was a near future sci-fi. And one of the things involved, it was like a police thing or whatever. And there was a psychologist who basically said, like, we've learned years ago that all of Freud and psychoanalysis is bullshit. And it's 100% a matter of brain chemistry. And so you just inject the right chemicals and things fixed. And of course, it ends up being that's not good enough and the bad guy is still bad and our hero has to, you know, beat him to death or whatever. Like, because shrinks don't know what they're talking about. But I did find that at the time, I thought that was very interesting because there's a lot of things, for me especially, that I think do come down to brain chemistry. But as with a lot of things also, the underlying causes and reality and all that are academically interesting. I'm way more interested in treating the symptoms. If you can effectively make me feel happy and good about my life, I don't really care what it was in the first place that was bugging me. Now, I mean, there are other side effects, which is why I don't just do a lot of fun drugs to feel good about my life, because there's other things. But I mean, like, if I can come to terms with a better knowledge and sense of peace of mind, I'm fine with if it was just my brain chemistry was off, or if it was that I was dealing with external stimuli, or if it was that I have evil genes. Whatever it is, I'm good. So I don't really care. And I think there are so many things that are on sort of the fringe of medical things. The biggest one for me, of course, being diets and nutritional plans and things like that are perfectly fine. As long as what they are these things have been shown to work for some people. And so sometimes they can work for other people. But that's never how it's done. It's always, I did a series of things and am physically healthier now. Therefore, I'm writing a book and you all do this and you all be healthy. Nope. And the same thing with mental health. Like, this is what I did. I was sad and I did these things and I'm not now. So now everybody has to do these exact things and you won't be sad.
Well, there's so many, when it comes to medical science, human medical science in particular, and human behavioral science, I mean, right now, this is coming up in my classes too, but this is something I saw lots before I was ever taking any classes. You know, the idea like you're talking about where, well, let's have something where...
Sucks. You look like you've been professionally lit for a music video, and I look like a dude sitting on his couch, which I am.
there, you know, there are people talking a lot about, well, we need to, you know, they call it having evidence-based. To me, it's odd that they call it that, evidence-based. What they mean is they want, when you come to, let's say you come to me and I'm a counselor, and they want to be able to have it so that when you come to me, I can ask you a bunch of questions. I can diagnose you, like, you know, like I can tell you what's wrong with you. Like there's a label for it, whatever it is. And I can tell you what clinical trials have proven are going to most likely help you. And then I can do that. Now, that all sounds great in a lot of ways.
They've got the data to back that up. I think that's awesome. Let's do that.
Okay. See, that's the trouble.
Exactly.
Because for one thing, I think people don't really understand, and this is true for human medical science too. They don't really understand how to really get what they want would require tests and experiments and things that you can't do. Well, not ethically.
Yeah.
Right? So you're stuck with these, you know, things where maybe you can get enough people and maybe your sample size can be high enough and maybe you can apply the right statistics to give you a significant result. And it's like, it's all kind of mushy, the research, and that's about as good as it can get. So,
which shouldn't even be a problem, because the more data you collect, the more you get a general sense of the picture. And as long as you realize you have a very general sense of the picture, that's fine. But it's always, well, with what data we have, we're determined it's definitely this box, and this is the only thing we're going to do going forward.
Yeah, that happens too. Yep.
That's the thing. I'm like, no, over time, if you collect enough data, you will learn things and you will find patterns and you will find generalities that encompass more and more people. But it's a constant, never-ending process. And you can't say, well, just give us however much data we've got and we'll say that's definitely the answer.
But the thing is, it's in practice, it's just really hard. I mean, there are so many variables that go into a person getting mental health care. There's, for one thing, there's whether or not they can have an adequate relationship with the therapist or the doctor, whoever it is. That, you know, there is actual research on that to show that's a pretty key thing. Well, that, how do you make that turn out right? How do you make sure that the person walking into this office is the right person to walk into that office? Then there's differences in communication styles, learning styles, cultural differences, all that are going to have an impact on even on whether or not what the person is telling you is going to be diagnosed as a problem, right? Because, well, it's just because this person says this and this person says the exact same thing doesn't mean they have the same problem. And one person might have a problem, the other person might not have any problem. So there's so many variables and so many things going on, and there's so much subjectivity in it, which is going to be true for most medical research and most human behavioral research especially. And there are attempts to quantify things that sometimes are completely just not even going to work or misconceived anyway. And so when you put it all together, oh, and then the problem that you've often talked about where, if you do get some research done, is it going to be replicated? Is it going to be, you know, all that stuff? Put it all together and you can understand why for a human behavioral science and for something as difficult to get your hands on as, you know, human consciousness and all that, it's going to be tricky, you know, and going to a counselor is going to be tricky. And some people find it fairly, I don't want to use the word traumatizing, but you know, you were saying what do you really lose by going? And that's true, you don't lose anything, but for some people it can be a real letdown when the therapist doesn't work.
In my case, I don't lose anything. I think there are people who do. And one of the many reasons that I finally overcame to do this is I was scared of the idea of going to a therapist and they suck for me.
Yeah.
Even though it just means, well, then don't go back. But like, there's an emo- there, putting the hope out there, essentially, for like, oh, this is gonna help. Oh no, it won't. And then I'm like, well, shit. Do I start again? Who do I find now? What I did my best to pick this one. How do I pick the next? Like, that was very disheartening. And the truth is, as long as I'm aware of what's going on, it's not that big a deal for me. But for some people, it very much is. And for me, it looked like it could have been.
There's a way to, I can't even think of a way to address that. I mean, how?
No, I think to bring it back around, though, I think you've hit on it. We're talking about such a nebulous and unquantifiable field. And we're also talking about a world in which, and especially a country in which, medicine as a whole is a business like anything else and is subject to economic pressures. You're not going to put the money and research into preventative, maybe will help. I think that's what it is. I think you would have to take a group and do a whole bunch of preventative mental health things, and have, like, the university should do a study where they're like, we fucked around with all these people's hearts, and with half of them, we had a therapist there to help them out, and half of them, we locked them alone in a windowless room. And here's how many of each set jumped out the window when they went home and killed themselves based on this. No, but I mean, this is why I don't make medical experiments, but you see what I'm getting at. This is a thing they absolutely could do because it's a no harm thing. The control group would just be how we're doing it right now.
That's true. That's true.
And the experimental group would be, we added this person to the team. I mean, cause I had that experience in a physiological one where we were dealing with my hypertension, and I was in an experimental group where the whole thing was the pharmacists were communicating with the doctors and together coming up with the medications. And so there was no real risk. My doctor was still involved, and my doctor still had, well, the second to last final say. I had the final say as a patient. But the control group was just how you always do it, which is that the doctor prescribes your things or whatever. So that one was totally ethical, and this one could be totally ethical too. I think you need to start getting together your grant proposal. I mean, this is straight up in your field now, so get on. Well, it.
Yeah, that's kind of funny you should say that, because one of the classes that I is finishing up here is multicultural counseling is what it's about, and I'm starting. I don't think there is a theory of a theory of cultural development. That we talk about culture, we talk about different people having culture or whatever, but I can't find anything anywhere. I should keep looking, because maybe it's somewhere where that talks about how a human being becomes aware of that culture exists. Now, part of the reason I can't find anything like that is because time after time after time, I see researchers seeming to insist that people aren't aware that culture exists, but I know that's not true. I mean, we're talking about it. So how do people become aware that culture exists?
I mean, my data is 20 some odd years out of date now, but at that time, I can tell you that's because within the field, there's still a lot of debate over what the smallest unit of culture is, and what the origin of culture is. So to just throw an example, because it's the one I can best remember, there is a school of thought that culture at its origin is based in language, and therefore your cultural awareness would be parallel to your linguistic development. Which makes sense, because we are dealing with symbolism in both cases.
But I'm talking about things like, because I sort of jotted down a preliminary idea about how this worked. Like, for example, cognitively, like a kid, at some point, a person cognitively realizes that another family might do things different than our family does. Or actually, maybe even before that, a kid might realize that you know, I can have a favorite food and this other person can have a different favorite food, right? Or this household can do things different than this household, or these people don't have to follow these rules, but I have to. Because all of these cognitive aware, you know, like you can imagine cognitively, someone might think that a made up rule is not made up. It's just like gravity and everything else. It's like, it applies to everybody. But then at some point they have to cognitively realize, oh, it doesn't apply to everybody. That's a made up rule versus this other rule. And so you eventually get those cognitive tools to help you understand that this is different than this. And eventually some kind of cultural awareness happens. And you see what I'm trying to say?
Yes.
I don't really have it all.
I think I absolutely do. And this is where you get into problem. And I think I know why there's not a lot, because I think the variability on that from person to person and from polity to polity and from culture to culture, for lack of a better term in this instance, varies widely.
You think so?
There are people out there who grew, depending on the communities, who can grow up to be middle-aged and never really get that some families do things different than other families and things like that. Yeah, no, cultural awareness is not a given in a human lifetime in our current society.
Right, but a lot of
cognitive... So I don't think there's a verifiable method.
But a lot of cognitive development isn't guaranteed. That's why we have a cognitive model. So we can say, what we would be establishing is, what's the earliest cognitive stage where we can expect a person to have this awareness, so that when they're 20 and they don't, we can say, well, this person...
So you want like a learning progression.
Yeah. This person's behind on their development, cultural development, because they had the cognitive ability to make this distinction when they were six, but they're not making it.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? That's how developmental models work.
Yeah. And my hunch is that it's interdisciplinary in a way that nobody's just found it interesting enough to try out, but you could be a pioneer in this. I like this. I like this idea. Well, I'd help you out if I didn't want to not put in effort. We need to move this along, because I got shit to talk about and we better get through those questions this week.
Sorry.
Hello, everyone. If you've stuck with us this far, I apologize for the headache. We got deep in this one. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world rated number one by J.B. Smoove and James Urbaniak and Associates and some other made up people. J.D. Powers is bullshit, is what I'm saying. When people on or Root Metric or whatever, those are companies that are literally like, pay us money and we'll tell everybody we think you're cool. And what I'm saying is, we made one up and they said we're the best podcast in the world.
Yep.
I'm Tony.
And I'm William. And this is episode 547.
Yes, it is.
And can't believe I remembered that.
With the grace of dog, we will finish the last two cards. So that will never happen. So if you've never experienced the show, we have a hat. It's magic. It has its own email address. It sends the emails to us and we read them. And you can write into it. The email address is themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. So do that. How's your week been?
There's a lot of cool things to talk about, but we don't really have time to talk about them. I'll just say one thing. A second cousin of mine that I never met, didn't even know I had until one of them contacted me via 23andMe. Stopped by and visited me at the, at the mall there. Yeah, it was kind of nice to meet her. So there's been a few other things, but that was the big thing. I got to meet my cousin who I didn't even know I had. Well, I suspected that there was a first cousin of Dad's that he didn't know that he lost contact with and didn't know whatever happened to this guy, a first cousin.
And you talked about that.
Yeah. Well, sometime after he passed, his granddaughter found me via 23andMe. And so we've been able to get reacquainted with that side of the family that sort of dropped off, you know, the face of the earth there for a little while.
So 22 to go.
Yeah. How was your week?
Are you up on Ted Lasso? Well, oh yeah, you binged. That's right. You guys binged the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I still haven't touched season two. Meanwhile, my gaming group all got guilted into it, and so they've all now watched season one also. I peer pressured them, so it's been helpful to have people talk about it. I still haven't done it. I think I'm gonna wait till season two's done to touch it.
Reasonable.
I had a thing in there. It wasn't about Ted Lasso. Something, I don't know. I have a movie I want to mention. And I want to speak about it very carefully. It is a movie currently on Netflix called Blood Red Sky. It is a horror film. It probably would qualify as a horror action film, but it's definitely a horror film. And I want to recommend it to people who hear the following criteria and think they might like to see it.
Okay.
But I want to speak very carefully about it, because the first thing I want to say is I think this movie would be, and I didn't get to experience it this way, but I think this movie would be incredibly awesome to watch if you went into it essentially knowing nothing about it. That being said, you can get the basic premise and it's still very cool. I liked it. Trish liked it. But there are certain things that I knew going in that I'm like, holy shit, if I didn't know this up front, this would be such a more intense trip, as it were. So I'm going to be very circumspect about what I say. It is a German film. It has subtitles. It's one of those space weavers like this too. I love these modern non-American made movies where there's actually like a bunch of different languages spoken in it. Cause this movie is a German made film. People speak a lot of German. People speak a lot of English. People speak some Arabic. People speak a little French and a little, Czech in some places. And I don't know, I just find that very fun and very sort of indicative of modern global community, which I really like. And you just got subtitles for everything. It is longer than a lot of movies nowadays. It's 2 hours and 3 minutes. It's a very original film in that it takes things you've seen before and puts them into a very interesting sort of layers of story that I think is very cool. It is very bloody. I wouldn't say it's particularly gory. It is very bloody. A couple of dogs die in it. That is a thing for some people, so be aware that happens. And yeah, it's just very, it's got a lot of layers and a lot of aspects to it and some interesting twists. And it's just, and it's a genuinely scary movie at times, but it's also a very sort of interesting, almost touching movie, I would say at times. And I will say, to my knowledge, I don't remember any jump scares. So that's not really a thing. So you can be okay with that. But yeah, I liked it a lot. I think Trish maybe even liked it more. I specifically think you and Abby would like it. In fact, I have this just hunch Abby might like it especially. But I think you guys would like it. Blood Red Sky, it's on Netflix. Y'all should check it out if you know you're into that kind of thing. Not a lot else, I don't think. I'm reading a book called Nine Fox Gambit, and it's a space opera sci-fi thing written by this Korean lady. And in fact, I think that the whole trilogy was originally in Korean and it got translated. And it's very interesting. It's also very strange. It's a galactic like empire in which everything is done via the calendar and belief in a specific set of calendars, and the belief in that calendar allows you to do weird thing. They call them exotic effects, where you can like have a supernatural almost impact on the world via certain actions and formations as long as you are in a place where everyone there believes in this particular calendar. And the Empire, basically, its military functions to go destroy heretics who come up with different calendars. And it sounds insane, and it is. And it's like, I understand it well enough that I can follow the story now, but I still don't really understand it. You know, like, I don't think I need to, but it's very weird. I feel very at sea, even though I'm totally following the story. And like, I could tell you beat for beat what's happening, and it's a compelling and interesting story, but I still feel very a little like, but I don't, like, they duel each other as sort of a ceremonial thing with calendrical swords. I have no idea what that means at all. I mean, I know the word calendrical ties into the word calendar and stuff, but like, I don't know what that's about. And just things like, and like, certain things can produce, can essentially transmit a particular calendrical belief out, like, in the surrounding spatial area. But like, it's very weird, but it's very well written, and I am enjoying it. I'm definitely going to finish this book. In the long run, will I finish the trilogy? I am less sure. And I think a lot of this may be very cultural too, because it's like I said, it's written from a Korean person. And there are a lot of elements of mythos and symbolism that are very clearly sort of East Asian in ways that I don't always fully get. So, I mean, some of it may just be that I'm too much of a white dude to really get it, but who knows? But it's kind of neat, a little different. Nine Fox Gambit is the first book. Check it out. All right, that's all I got. Let's do this thing.
Let's do it.
Last two. Actually, I do want to talk about one other thing. I want to talk about how bad I am at cooking.
At cooking?
Yes.
Oh.
But also, it's because cooking is fucking insane. So, supper with their neighbors. On the week, every Sunday we do this, except we did it Monday because of Labor Day. And so I was going to make the main dish, and it's a thing. Trish's family has a lot of things that they call by certain names that don't necessarily work elsewhere. Like in this example, they have a dish that's called barbecue beef. It's basically a version of Sloppy Joe's. So if you tell most people barbecue beef, they're going to think something very different. But this is basically a version of Sloppy Joe's. And here's how you make it. Here is the recipe, sort of. You brown some ground beef. You throw in a bunch of other crap that makes it into like sort of a barbecue-y, tangy sauce. You brown some ground beef, drain the beef, throw the other crap in there, which a lot of it is ketchup, but there's other things. And it makes this sort of sauce in it. And then you spoon it over like, usually hamburger buns, we do like open face sandwich kind of thing. It's very good. So I'm going to make this. I did a couple things slightly different. And the first thing I did was not bad. In fact, I would say it was quite good. Is I took all the things and I mixed them together beforehand. So I just had a bowl of the sauce. And in fact, I tasted it. I'm like, yeah, it tastes like barbecue beef when my mother-in-law makes it. So I must have done the sauce right. That's good. I'm just going to mix it with the beef. It'll be great. Then, however, I put the raw ground beef into the pot, going to start browning it. And I was like, you know, if I add the sauce now, it'll really, you know, absorb into the meat and make it really flavorful and stuff. So I'll do that. And I did. And I'm working. And about 30 seconds later, I'm like, oh, shit, now I can't drain the fat out of it. Right. Fuck. And I'm like, well, okay, it'll have more fat. It should still be a thing. But what I didn't know is there are two side effects by adding the sauce in before it had cooked. One is that you can't drain the fat out. And the other is that it transforms the dish into something with a completely different look, texture, flavor, everything. It is completely different. It turns into this weird sort of pate almost, in a really unappetizing gray color with an incredibly very subtle, you can barely tell it's there, flavor of the sauce and everything, which is a very strong and tangy sauce normally with that. I don't know what this alchemy is, but Trish is coming along and she's like trying to help. And so she's doctoring it up. She's like, well, I'll add more of this or whatever. And eventually I'm like, should we just skip that? Like, should we? I don't. And she's like, I think we. And finally I said, okay. I'm not going to Cheney Supper, we'll say. I made this and then I'm fucking off to a gaming thing or whatever. You have to take this to Cheney's. Do you do it or do you come up with something else? And she thought about it for, I'm going to say conservatively, 10 minutes. And then finally she said, yeah, maybe we should take something else. And I was like, thank you. I'm going to order Pizza Hut. So we had Pizza Hut. The good news is, I actually think it tastes fine personally. Like it tastes very different and I wouldn't want to serve it to them, but I think it tastes fine. So I just put it in freezer containers and I put it away. And actually I think I can turn it into a nice sort of chili mac or something. Or Trish was like, let's just get some Cheese Whiz. We'll make it into a dip. I don't know, but it was absolutely in like, it might've just like magically turned into a head of cauliflower. It was so different than the end product normally is, just by having put the sauce in before browning the beef. Cooking is weird, is what I'm saying. Right. Y'all got that recipe, right, though? Brown ground beef, drain it, throw some stuff in. Eat. See, we give you recipes on this show sometimes. All right, this is from Agitalon. Tony! Make William tell us about some of his, quote, not really, unquote, supernatural experiences he mentioned in Talking Head Syndrome.
You got to go back to like the first 10 episodes or something. Like,
I was going to say, he has talked in detail about specific ones long ass time ago. I have done my best to forget all of them, but I seem to remember one taking place in a church, not during church time, and one while you were like jumping over a fence.
No, this was I was in Russia and someone else jumped over
a
wall that he thought there was like a pool or something over there, but it turned out to be a stairway. And so he fell, broke his back, had to stay in Russia actually after we all left. This was back in 1985. Lives there
to this day.
No.
And he grew up to be. No, I don't know. I don't know a good Russian around that age to say. So.
Yeah, he had to stay behind.
Yeah, no, I remember he's talked about these before. It is. I don't know if it's in the first 10, but it's pretty early.
Very early.
But you have talked about them. And mm-hmm. Mostly I remember that you also fully acknowledge it might have all been in your head, which I think is an important thing to say.
I don't think it might have been. I think it was. Conclusion. Okay. Yeah. I mean, other people can hear me talk about it and draw their own conclusions. But my conclusion, even back in the day, there wasn't a period of time where I spent believing that it was what it was. After these things happened and I thought about it, it's like, what was that? My conclusion pretty much immediately was something in my head. Because I was kind of raised to think like that.
Years later, you developed exploding head syndrome. I would say you are on track to become like one of the bigger characters in Stephen King's The Stand. Like, I think the apocalypse is going to hit, and I'm not sure which side you're going to be on, but you're going to be like one of the major players on one side or the other. Have you started drawing comic books that weirdly tell the future? That would be a useful step.
I'm looking forward to that. I think I sometimes oversell the whole skeptic thing, though, because I wasn't raised to think that certain things couldn't happen. And there have been times in my life, I saw some things I wrote like 10 or 15 years ago. I was a little surprised at what I wrote and how I wrote it, because it indicated a person who was even more open to those things than I am now. So there's been different times in my life where I've been more open to certain things. So I don't want to oversell the whole skeptic thing. Like, I just don't believe in anything. I'm very open to, I like to hear people's stories about things. I don't think I know everything. A lot of this stuff could be real. And I just haven't gotten enough evidence or whatever yet, but I am a skeptic in the sense that if a person's going to make really incredible claims, they better have incredible evidence. And as someone who has experienced some things firsthand that I would say were cognitively and emotionally unusual, even for me, those things didn't surpass that high standard of, you know what I mean? Even at that age, I knew that there were a lot of things you can imagine. And this just seemed like one of those things to me. So,
yes. And I, as the mundane avatar of ultimate supernatural power, and essentially deity made flesh, represented here on earth in front of you, Neo Jesus, if you will, think that's a very healthy attitude to have. And I would encourage you to continue such an attitude. Me and the other higher powers think you're doing all right.
To sum up both experiences, and I'd be surprised if, I mean, maybe he just doesn't remember because he's been listening the whole time, right? As you're telling.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, he claims it. He claims he's been listening since the beginning. I have a theory that Azure Talon is not one person, but more sort of an office. And as one Azure Talon dies, another one takes its place.
Okay, well, both.
I don't know if it's like a Batman thing or like a Santa Claus with Tim Allen thing. I haven't figured it out yet.
To sum up, both experiences were similar in that they involved if I were to interpret them as supernatural, they would both have involved an interaction with a higher spiritual entity of some kind. Maybe God himself or an angel, or, you know, there was some kind of interaction there between myself and some higher power, or at least that's what I would probably interpret it to be if I believed that's what it was. They both had those things in common.
I know this will never happen, but how I want this to go is that then someday in the near future, you're like, fuck it. And you decide to try alcohol and you get really drunk. And the next morning you're like, oh, that's what it was. Holy shit, guys. Dead on. Exactly the same feeling. I had no idea.
I would think it'd have to be like LSD or something like that. Yeah,
but you have no frame of reference. That's why I think it's a funny idea.
Yeah, like, I suppose. That's true.
I had a shot of schnapps last night. Felt exactly like the times I experienced the supernatural firsthand. It was so similar. I can't even. All right. Are you ready for this? The last of the great note cards. So it ends. Not with a bang, but with a note card. And our 1 millionth customer, the final note card from Dave of Id.
Wow. Congratulations, Dave of Id.
So you know how at the beginning they like address us, you know, like dear hat hosts or whatever. This one's very interesting because the beginning, which one could assume was an address to us. You could assume. I'm not saying that's what it is, but that's the position it normally has. Just says dead, alive, or fictional. I mean, thanks a lot, Dave. Dead, alive, or fictional. Who would you love to have on as a guest host? Dave of Id.
Dead, alive, or fictional?
I'm bad. I mean, I'm not as bad at these as you are, but I'm bad at these. All I can do is think back to, like, who do I think the most fun podcast hosts I've ever listened to are.
Right. I mean, this is when we've been asked similar questions, that's usually where we go, because it's like, well, who would, you know, because this is a podcast, you know, even if it was someone we liked and wanted to talk to, it's got to be someone who can talk to both of us, can talk to both of us in a way that's entertaining to the listeners. I mean, if it'd be a different thing if you and I were just going to go have dinner with this person, or if you were going to have dinner, or if I was going to have dinner with them, but there's a whole other dimension of consideration when it's, you know, on the podcast.
I mean, so I hate to say it, but sort of any British comedian that I've enjoyed on a panel show. So Sandy Toksvig, Richard Iowade, David Mitchell, Sarah Pasco, Dara O'Brien, Phil Jupitus, Rosie Jones. Rosie Jones is having a moment right now. I would love to have her on here. Sean Locke, rest in peace. Speaking of Sean Locke dying, I'm going to talk about somebody else dying. Michael K. Williams died. And I was shook up by that more than I expected to be. I don't think of myself as a fan of his, mostly because I didn't watch Oz or The Wire, which were his big things. But I really have kind of been a fan of his. And I was really sad to hear that because I really... I mean, I obviously I didn't know the guy. People say he was nice. Who knows? I thought he was a real special acting talent that like would have gone on to grow and do lots more interesting things throughout his career. Like, I think that's what it comes to for a lot of these actors that I don't know is I'm like, I can't, Chadwick Boseman's a huge version of this. I can't help but feel that if they had lived, I would have benefited from a whole bunch of performances that I hadn't seen yet and that won't be replicated by someone else. I feel like they would have done things that the world just misses out on now. And I think that's often what really sort of gets me.
Yep, I agree with that.
And Michael K. Williams really felt that way as well. So yeah, let's have both of those guys on as co-hosts, Mike K. Williams, Chadwick Boseman. Sarah Vowell, how about that one? Haven't heard from her in a while, but Sarah Vowell would be a really good one, I think. She'd be fun.
It's not that particular about who we sit down and have a conversation.
And if you go into the like, oh, we could have historic ones or whatever. Or even fictional ones in most cases. I'm like, real quickly, if you go too far into the past or too far into a different sort of world, I'm like, we couldn't have a real non-awkward conversation, you know? Because, like, would it be interesting to meet Abraham Lincoln in person? Yeah. Would we put together a decently entertaining podcast episode, the three of us? Fuck no.
No, like, see, what would happen with Abraham Lincoln is, first of all, no, wouldn't make a good podcast. Then we decide to take him to IHOP, and he would just be shoveling it in the whole time because he'd just be amazed at all the different types of pancakes.
Which, that I'm fine with. I would love that part. But we'd have to do that first, because if he was on a podcast with me and he would hate me within 5 minutes. I would be just making jokes to left and right, and he'd be trying to make points. That lets out a whole bunch of people. A whole bunch of people would come on here and in earnest try and have in-depth discussion, and I'd keep trying to make it funny, and eventually they'd be like, I'm gonna fucking slap you. Like, the Dalai Lama would say that if he was on our podcast within 10 minutes. The Dalai Lama would say, I'm gonna fucking slap you to me.
There are a lot of people. Okay, let's say Isaac Asimov, for example.
All right.
Who I've read his fiction, his nonfiction.
That would be awesome, because we'd be like, have you seen the trailers for the new Foundation thing? What do you think that's going to be like? Why did they not get you to consult on that? That's super weird.
I have no idea.
Like, I know, right?
I have no idea if he was any kind of conversationalist. I mean, I don't know.
Oh, okay. But we can do this then. So Mark Twain, Dorothy Parker, maybe Ben Franklin. Like, there are people who are known.
Oh, known for that. Yeah.
Truman Capote. We could have some great ones there. But the problem also is if we get some of the good ones very quickly, we're just relegated to the back and we hardly get to talk. Like,
yeah, right.
It can't be that good.
Okay.
So that then we just sort of fall out of the episode.
I'm used to that though myself. So.
Yeah, no, you'd stay in the same place regardless. But I'd need people that, rather than also making me like second William, would group around together, and collectively we would like shame you and
belittle. You'd become first William and I'd become second William. That's how that would work.
only after trial by combat, when that weird Star Trek music was playing in the background.
Yep.
That is, to this day, that might be my favorite thing out of Futurama, is where they visit Zoidberg's planet, and through a bunch of wacky misunderstandings, Zoidberg and Fry are fighting to the death. And before they start, they say, "But first, our planet's national anthem." And there's a woman, like at baseball games, had a little organ, and she plays that music from Star Trek. And it cracks me up every time.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's hard to say.
Oh.
I mean, like Carl Sagan, he's a person who I admired a lot of his work. But could he and I have a conversation? There's, you know, I'm sure he was a good conversationalist, but maybe he and I wouldn't have a very good one for some reason. I don't know. You just don't know.
Yeah, and there's a lot of comedians that I think could hold pretty well. This is a tough one. Because, like, everybody and nobody is the answer. I mean, not anybody that I would fucking hate. And not anybody who is famously not a good speaker. And
I guess I don't really think of anybody except people I know. You know, you hear people say, "Boy, I'd sure like to talk to so-and-so and pick their brain," or whatever. I can't think of anyone I could name like that. Like, oh, right? there are things like, is there something specific I want to talk to Carl Sagan about? No.
That's the thing. I'm to like,
pick his brain about.
When it comes to like the world's mysteries and stuff and things that like we can't ever know and I want to know, they frequently aren't tied to like specific people.
Yeah.
In a way, like, you know, it would be great if we could have a co-host that could definitively tell us who shot JFK. But like, I don't know who that would be.
The last one
we might have been able to do would have been before Mark Felt came out as being Deep Throat. That might have been a fun one. But otherwise...
Right. So, yeah, like you're saying, if there's some specific piece of factual information you can get that nobody knows, now, but like if it's philosophical,
we're allowed fictional, so it goes either way. So we can go for the pirate who buried all the treasure on Oak Island. And then we can find out where it is and how that worked, like that kind of shit. Like,
yeah.
I'd love to have Bigfoot as a co-host. Because then we'd find out if Bigfoot was real, which is funny because, again, it can be fictional. So it'd be great if Bigfoot shows up and is like, "Hey, happy to be here. So, Bigfoot, tell us, are you real?" No, I'm made up. Like, I love being able to get out and do this, but I am completely fictional, guys. Sorry to disappoint. And then we'd be like, "Well, okay, I feel like any follow-up question is going to be useless because none of it's true."
Right.
So good night, everyone.
I mean, I can't even think of a question I would ask Carl Sagan or Isaac. Like, I don't have there's no burning thing I wish I could ask or that I need to know. So it's like, I don't really need to sit down and have a conversation with this person.
I don't have that either.
And although I feel weird
about that, because I feel like most people do. In my head, most people have things like that, but I don't have it either.
When I think of sitting down and talking to a famous person, I almost always imagine just having an ordinary conversation, like finding out, you know, things about their childhood or you know, what their favorite restaurant is and stuff like that. I mean, just personal stuff, not really anything deep.
I will say, I also imagine sort of getting their, like, especially if it's somebody from history, getting their take on how things are now. But
that'd be interesting.
But especially right now, I feel like that would just be depressing, like whoever it was.
I think I do sometimes imagine I take it back. There are some questions I can think of, questions I can ask very specific people, but it has to do with, usually they're musicians, and I want to ask them, why did you do that? Why did you make that creative choice for that particular thing? Maybe with some filmmakers too, maybe some.
There's also the thing where like history doesn't know why so-and-so did whatever.
Yeah. Right.
And so-and-so made it that way. So even if you could get them now and ask them, they might totally lie.
True.
So then that becomes, who would you like to have on the podcast strapped to a chair and filled up with sodium pentothal? Like that becomes a whole other deal.
Because I had an opportunity to ask Neil Gaiman a question just like that. I was in Minneapolis and Jazz was there. Jazz and I were both there. Neil Gaiman was there. So I asked him, you know, about the whole, about how a lot of his themes are so mythic, you know, and what was behind that? You know, what is this something he had an interest in when he was a kid? I mean, I don't remember exactly how I asked the question, but it was something along those lines. I was just curious about what's his process. I mean, why does he, you know, specifically it was, I think I was asking about Sandman and, you know, the Endless and stuff like that. It's like, you know, what's that all about? His answer wasn't particularly satisfying, I have to be honest, but it was, I'm sure it was true. And it was because I've seen other things from him where he basically says this same kind of thing, which is, he didn't have a plan. He didn't have an idea. You know, he wasn't really out to create some kind of new myth or anything like that. In the same way, say, George Lucas claims, you know, he was trying to make kind of a new myth or whatever with Star Wars. Gaiman was, he wasn't trying to do anything like that. He was just, you know, yeah, he was probably drawing from things that, you know, he liked that kind of stuff when he was a kid, myth and stuff. And he was probably just drawing from all that, threw it on the page. And what I've heard him say later in other places is, the drafts after your first draft are meant to make it look like you knew what you were doing all along. So that was kind of his answer, was basically, I know I didn't have a plan. I don't have an interest in kind of creating anything like that. I just put it together based on, you know, stuff. And then in subsequent, you know, drafts and whatever, it became what it was. That's basically how he answered it.
It's interesting and not at all ironic that you bring this up right now. 'Cause I just today finally started listening to the audio play that they've done of Sandman.
Oh, okay.
Audible created a thing that's like the first three volumes or whatever. And I've kind of dragged my feet because honestly, I might have progressed past the point where Sandman means a lot to me anymore. Like, I'm so glad it was in my life and I read it, but I've been thinking, like, should I reread it? And I'm like, I'm not sure what it would do now. But I've been reading those Peter Grant, listening to those Peter Grant novels back to back to back to back. I'm like, I should take a break. I've got this thing. And I started listening to it. No, it's awesome. It's a full cast audio for voices, but Gaiman, who is always great to hear Gaiman read things. His voice is amazing for that. And he does all the narration, and they've got a full orchestral score to it. And it's really, something about this is giving me the same kind of vibes like reading it for the first time. It's really fascinating. I'm really enjoying that.
Jazz was there. Maybe I'm not remembering the whole interchange that he and I had, so maybe she wants to add something to
Jazz, what I said. 100%. Get on the blog and tell us you've never met William in person. You don't know what the hell he's talking about.
We are both there.
Let's gaslight the shit out of William. I feel like he has given us a great opportunity. Let's make it happen, Jazz. Do it.
He might remember it completely differently than I. And if she does, then she probably remembers it right, and I remember it wrong. I don't know. My memory's terrible. We all know.
We got to wrap this up. And now that we have finished our note cards, I've written a little song to say farewell to our little blue friends. It goes a little like this. No, I didn't do that. No, definitely not. Not even close. I didn't even have a thought of doing that until 10 seconds ago, and I would never have, so it's not real. But we are done with this, and next time we will just be reading actual emails. We're probably, the recording is going to be a little out of sync. I mean, we'll still drop them on Thursday for you guys, but in our world, it's going to be different because someone's having open heart surgery.
Week from tomorrow.
Yeah. I'm going to be glad when that shit's done. I mean, I'm sure it's no biggie for you, but it's kind of freaking me out.
It's freaking me out already. Well, you know, when I did, when the whole aneurysm scare thing didn't bother me at all, really, but this kind of does.
I think that one was sort of almost too fast. Like, we knew it might be a thing, and then it turned out it wasn't a thing.
And then it wasn't
and
a
it
thing.
Was still a time, but it was like it was like days in my memory.
Yeah.
Saying, like, this is a thing, maybe. Oh, no, it turns out it was okay. This one is like weeks and weeks and weeks.
Plus, it's going to happen.
That's always just rougher. Yeah, but it's always the anticipation.
Yeah. And then there's like a long recovery and you're going to be in the hospital for a week and stuff. It's like a whole different thing.
I did love going on to Facebook and seeing your wife say, in frankly, overly polite terms, just in general to people, don't expect me to make prompt Facebook updates while my husband is in surgery. I was like, oh, sweetie, you are being way too nice. I'm like, this is, yeah, the fuck you won't. I mean, oh my God. I saw that and I'm just like, oh shit. Does she actually know people such that she feels she's got to make this kind of thing? Because that's sad. It's sad that there are people who can't make that leap deductively on their own.
Well, yeah. I mean, I just
love the idea. Hey! It was 3 hours ago he went under. What's going on? Her wall is just full of people like, out of surgery yet? Out of surgery yet?
Well,
Facebook is such trash.
You know, I'm not on Facebook anymore. So it's like, not like I said anything on Facebook about it. So for
your
a lot
status,
of people,
feeling awake, chest itchy.
Yeah, she, I think she wanted also just to make people aware it was even going to happen because a lot of people might not, know.
Well, yeah. I think there's some earth, but that one, no. And I, like, I'm lamenting the fact that she felt the need to do that. I'm not questioning the need. I think it was probably very smart of her to do that. I'm much more like, not why did Abby do that, but what the fuck is wrong with humanity that Abby had to do that? And also, good on you for doing it that way, because if I had done that version, I would have been like, I mean, the phrase fuck off would have shown up at least 4 times in that post if I had done it. And maybe what the hell is wrong with you people?
Like, she feels that way about it. I think she wanted
very nice.
She wanted people to know, and she wanted people to have certain expectations about it. I think, yeah.
No,
so
she was super sweet about it. I was just like, oh, I wonder if there are people reading this going, oh, really? Huh. I really thought you kept up. Like, I get mad if somebody was like, why are you taking so long to post on Facebook? Full stop, let alone while your husband's having open heart surgery. Jesus.
I don't know how that whole thing, I mean, you know, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to be too busy doing other things.
You'll be asleep. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
So, she's got to deal with all that stuff. And I feel bad.
You're going to dream that you're hanging out in Minneapolis with Jazz meeting Neil Gaiman, apparently.
Now, here's the thing. You know, if it wasn't for the whole COVID thing, like, because she's going to have to tell, like, my dad and my family, who would normally be here.
Oh, yeah, we all would fucking be there.
Yeah, so that's part of it is...
We'd all be doing that classic bit in the waiting room and one person goes to get shitty coffee and one person paces and all of that shit.
Yeah, well, and that's just not going to, you know... No. last
and she knew, has set up channels for communication, and part of that thing said DM me if you know you want that. That's stuff.
Right. I don't know how many. I mean, a month ago or 2 weeks ago, however, 3 weeks, they were saying that they were letting two people at a time after I'm out of ICU. But they thought that was going to change, and we're kind of in the midst of the state of Iowa is kind of in the midst of reevaluating its whole COVID thing right now because of the increase in cases and deaths and hospitalizations, all that. So that's like when I met my cousin, I wore a mask and everything because the last thing I want, I mean, I don't think COVID would be a big deal
and be able to find you later.
No. And she had a mask on too, because she said, hey, I know you've got surgery and stuff and I don't want you to have to postpone it.
Oh yeah.
That's what I'm worried about. I don't think I'd get that sick if I got COVID, but if I test positive before the surgery, I won't get the surgery, and that I don't want that. So I masked up and she did, which I thought was very nice. And so, you know, yeah, it's this whole COVID thing coming back is depressing, but it is what it is, but I guess.
You focus on this thing. We'll take care of COVID.
Take care of it, huh?
Right. By the time you're out of the hospital,
it'll all be taken care of. All right. Good. I hope so. That would be awesome.
Now you know why the Dalai Lama hates me, because I say shit like this. He gets so mad. Have you ever had the Dalai Lama shake his fist at you? I don't think a lot of people have. It's intimidating. Which is funny because he's like 102, and so it looks like it might be a palsy, but you can tell he's mad.
No, when the Dalai Lama visits me, we just sort of sit there and look at each other. We don't really say anything.
That tracks.
Yeah.
Except now I'm trying to figure out what the Dalai Lama visits me actually means. All right, people. Write in to themagicaltalkinghead@gmail.com with whatever. Just email us and we will read it. We'll talk about it. That's how the show's going to work now. It's going to be great. And in the meantime, have a good time and be all safe. And a fun game to play at home. Get a friend. And one of you pretend to be me, and one of you pretend to be my new therapist, and just improv it. It'll be hilarious, trust me.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.